I imagine that many of you have had the experience before where you're bringing together groups of people that don't normally interact. Maybe you are a host who's bringing together a set of friends from one part of your life and another part of your life for some reason and thinking, I hope this all works out. Maybe it's really exciting in some ways, but then also it can be a little bit nervous. What if people don't end up hitting it off the way that I thought? Maybe it's blending two sides of a family. Maybe it's like work friends and church friends or something like that. But it has that sense of it can work out, and maybe even in ways I don't expect because there's so many unusual variables, but it also maybe won't turn out quite the way that I hope. Maybe you've also been a person who not was bringing groups of friends together, but was one of the groups of friends, and you came into it. Maybe for some of you that's exciting, maybe you're a real extrovert, and you're thinking, here's my chance to meet some new people, to maybe help that difficult situation otherwise. But also that can be nervous too. I don't know if I want to try to meet a bunch of new people. Maybe I'll just stick around with the people I already know. It's a little bit easier. There's a time in my life that I remember being in that position of sort of blending a group of people who had someone in common, but I was on sort of the outside. I wasn't bringing the two groups together. I was one of the people who was kind of being blended. And that was with Wendy, when we were not early in dating, but we met at college, and so I'd met some of her friends a little bit. I had only met her parents once or twice, and not for very long. And so one of the times where, this was before we were even engaged, but we knew that we were serious, from what I remember, it was when we were going back and I was helping her pack up some things before she was going to go and move to India for 6 months. She knew that after that she was going to move to California where I was going to seminary. So we knew that it was serious, but there was still some of that sense of like, well, maybe this won't work out or something, I guess, was hanging over it. But also there during this visit was her best friend from college, who lived not in the same town that she grew up in, but not too far away. So she would often come and hang out at Wendy at her house with her parents when they would come and get together. And so it was myself and Wendy, her friend Sherry, and Wendy's parents. And I remember throughout that weekend there, I'd met them before, it wasn't new, but it still felt a little bit of pressure because Wendy's about to go to India far away, and then I'm about to move her, because of her relationship with me, to far away also. And so were her parents going to have a little bit of a feeling about that, or were they going to be welcoming and happy about it with me? And then Sherry, her friend, already had this really great relationship because they had met Wendy's freshman year in college, and Sherry had then spent a bunch of time with Wendy and her folks all through those 4 years and had a better relationship with Wendy's parents than I did. And this thing that Sherry was able to do in her relationship with them was to call them mom and dad. And for me, I was probably just taking some of my own insecurity or projecting a little bit. But as, you know, the person who's maybe going to get in a long-term relationship and get married, where that's sort of more a traditional new person to call someone mom and dad, but you've got to sort of like navigate the eggshells of when is that appropriate, when does it feel a little bit too forward or too presumptive. Every time she said it, I just had this weird kind of competitive feeling, like, I just want her to stop doing that. Like, it feels awkward for me, and you're just kind of jumping in. And, you know, I mean, like, that's not fair for me to get all insecure myself about a healthy relationship they had. I learned later that that was really meaningful to her because she had a somewhat difficult relationship with her own parents, and Wendy's parents had been wonderfully supportive of her, and so that was actually something beautiful that they had together. But for me, it was really hard in that moment. Every time it happened, I just kind of glanced over at Wendy, wish it could end, or just not be on the table for that thing. I thought, well, should I try now because Sherry is? And like, so maybe everybody's just doing this and it's okay. Maybe I'm trying too hard. And eventually everything all worked itself out. I just remember that moment and that day just feeling so strange for so long and having to kind of work through what those feelings were, that sense of competitiveness, that sense of desire for control in my relationship with Sherry, in my relationship even with Wendy, in my relationship with her parents. And it all went through and great, but that did hang over things a little bit. And that came to mind for me a lot when I learned some of the things about the background of the city of Ephesus, which is where Paul wrote this letter to Ephesians that Pat wrote earlier. And like he said, Paul was in prison at that point and wrote a number of letters to Ephesians, to the Philippians, and then also to the Colossians. So we'll have those letters coming up soon. But Ephesus had this really interesting history. Many of you may have heard of Ephesus before, separate from the Bible, because they were home to one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Temple of Artemis, this enormous, grand temple. People would come from all over the world to see it just because it was so magnificent, but also to participate in the cultic worship of Artemis, which in Ephesus had an emphasis on fertility, in addition to protecting the city itself against, like, the rest of the world. So Artemis was also a very local deity. And so people knew about it, and it was a really big deal to the city. And there was some of those same feelings of, like, who's in control? Do I feel competitive for the Ephesians? The same way that I was just talking about with Wendy and her friend. See, Artemis was also a Greek goddess. She was the goddess of the hunt and the moon in the Greek pantheon. But Artemis for Ephesus actually started even before they had full contact with the Greeks. And as they did, the Greeks kept trying to pull the meaning of Artemis away from them and into the meaning of the Greek Artemis. And so they had this tension of who's in control of our religion or our local city. They got conquered multiple times, like a lot of that area of the world, as we've learned about before, with empire after empire getting as much land as they could. So they had dealings like the ancient Israelites, with the Babylonians, with the Persians, with Alexander the Great, and of course with the Romans. And multiple times, those conquering powers destroyed the temple, and they had to rebuild it. So first this happened with the Persians, and the Persians offered to actually make the expense of rebuilding the temple as a way of gaining favor with the city. And Alexander the Great then, a few hundred years later, did the exact same thing. And both times, you had that same feeling you could see coming out of, like, no, we want to be in control. We feel competitive about this. Who's in ownership of our faith and religiosity? We do not want you to pay or have any hand in rebuilding this temple. This temple is ours. And then we see that same thing coming out when Paul had interactions in Ephesus, when he spent time there on his missionary journeys. We read in Acts 19 how as Paul was beginning to form a church in Ephesus, that some of the people who did work around the temple got really mad at him. There's a story of a man named Demetrius, who was a silversmith, and one of his main areas of business was to make idols, small idols that people could buy for themselves that modeled the same idol of Artemis in the temple. And he rounded up a big, giant mob of people that were really angry, saying, Paul and these new followers of the way, these Christians, this new community, they are taking away attention and worship from our city goddess of Artemis, and we don't want that to happen anymore. And Demetrius was especially upset because he was losing customers, essentially. So it wasn't just the faith aspect of it. It was like, you're putting your hand in my pocket and taking food out of my mouth. And so this builds up, and everyone's worried that they're going to attack Paul and some of the other Christians and throw them in jail or beat them up. And the city official comes out and has this very different take on the situation. Everyone is steeped in these feelings of control and competitiveness around their religion. And the city official comes out and says, these guys are not saying anything bad about Artemis. They're not coming in and trying to destroy the temple. They're just saying their own ideas about religion and God and the way things work. Why are you turning this into a riot? The Roman soldiers are going to come after us for having a riot, and you might try to beat up Paul, but then the soldiers are going to beat all of us up. Can you please just calm things down and let's move along? You've got to get rid of this spirit of control and competitiveness. It's not good for anybody. But clearly from this history in Ephesus, from the interactions that Paul had, we know that that spirit of control and competitiveness was really on Paul's mind for what the people of Ephesus, even in the Christian church that were trying to step away from the cult worship of Artemis, understood their religion to be like. In Acts 20, we also see Paul giving a departing speech to the leaders. We don't see this captured in Acts with a lot of the churches, but it's almost the whole chapter, basically Paul giving a sermon to the leaders about what is going to happen and how they should try to lead the church as it continues to grow. And the main focus of that is Paul anticipating that there will be people coming in and creating competing ideas and fighting over control over how the church is going to work. He says that it will come both from people already within the church as he leaves, and maybe they decide, all right, so Paul's kind of gone, there's a power vacuum, who's going to step up? But also people from outside of the church that might come in, he says, like wolves, and try to turn the focus of their faith away from the way that God really wants it to be. And one of the things I think is really interesting that then happens in the letter to Ephesians, probably because of Paul being so mindful of these issues of control and competitiveness in people's idea of religion and faith, is that Paul uses the word love more in this letter than he does in anywhere else of his writings. The word love shows up in the letter to Ephesians a fifth of the times total that Paul uses it. But Ephesians only represents about 1/15 of all of Paul's writings. So he uses the word love in Ephesians 3 times more than you would normally expect if it was just proportional. And this emphasis on love, I think, makes a lot of sense. We all in our religious communities and even in our other relationships aspire especially to have the sense of regard and care for other people to be really foundational to helping our relationships, helping our communities operate healthily together. And we want to do that instead of being competitive, instead of being controlling, instead of being selfish or mean-spirited. But we know also, like I mentioned in the children's message, that talking about love not always just simple and easy. Sometimes we can get a little bit sweet or mushy about love, but it doesn't tell the whole story. Is love really just about letting people do whatever they think is best? They have nice, happy feelings towards you? Or is there that element of love where you're saying we are going to set a boundary about certain things? We are going to have some sort of standard or ethic that we'll ask anyone to hold themselves to as part of this love that we come together. I think we know in principle that that's really important, but we also know that that can get really dicey. Because think about how many times any idea of people projecting judgment and saying, you have to do things exactly the way that I want, you are letting me down, you're doing something that's a violation, that when we do that as part of our faith, how people often feel that it's those moments that most show us potentially corrupting or missing out on our Christian value of love. So how do we hold all those things together? I know for me in my faith, some of the people that I love to read most in the Bible, that I aspire to think about following the most in what my faith looks like in God, is in the prophets, in the Old Testament, or in the prophetic sayings of Jesus. And they especially have that sense of something has gone wrong in the world. We need to set a sense of boundary and standards so that things are better for everyone. And it can even seem fiery sometimes. And yet, I wouldn't say that being a prophet takes you away from a spirit and value of love. Paul certainly preaches about love and then also has some sense of boundaries. We've read before how he got pretty mad at people trying to make Christians who were not Jewish already get circumcised, said some pretty colorful language about some of those folks, if you remember. And yet, for Paul, he can see how those things exist at the same time. So, as we try to navigate those same things in our own life and be a community that is marked by love, have faith that is marked by love, and balancing what that means as we set boundaries and are also welcoming, how do we navigate all of those things that come to mind for what that is? I think our readings today actually help us see that full, robust picture without being wishy-washy. But it can take a little bit of reflection to get there. One thing to know about Paul's writings on love in particular, and some of you may have heard this before, is that there's sort of a stereotype in language about how, you know, different people who focus on certain things to a certain amount will expand their language around it, whereas people who don't have to think about it as much kind of narrow their language. And so one I hear about a lot is, you know, like the Eskimos have like 28 words for snow, right? We have snow. Maybe we say it's like packing snow or flaky snow or something. That's about it, right? You may have heard that the Greeks had a lot of different words for love. And we know that sometimes in English, like, love can feel like the just using that word for lots of different relationships is a little bit weird. So the Greeks tried to break it down. You may have heard that they had the word eros for like romantic, passionate love. Philia, or friendship love. That's where Philadelphia comes from, for instance. Having an affinity together. Storge is the love that you would have between a family or a sense of belonging to a group, including your country or another group like that. Pragma is the love that you have when there's a long-term commitment based on shared interests. So that could be what a long-term relationship turns into from eros, or also a business relationship that's really important. Ludus is playful love that can be goofy or flirty between friends or between people who are early in a relationship. Philautia is love that is showing self-care so that you don't drain yourself when you try to care for others. And then there's even mania, which you can probably guess, means obsessive, selfish, possessive love, which you wouldn't want to go into. And then the classic one that we hear a lot in the church, because it's also the word that Paul uses the most, is agape, which is universal, selfless love, where you're recognizing things that are beyond yourself, and you're trying to hold yourself accountable to that, to whoever you come in contact with. Again, that's where Paul puts his most emphasis, including all the instances of love in our passage today. But what's really important to know about the distinctions between all these types of love and why Paul might choose agape in particular is that how we distinguish between the types really has less to do about who the person is that's loving or even the relationships between people for love. It's not about the party that it's actually about who or what is in control of the values of the love, who the love is accountable to, ultimately. And so this should sound pretty familiar and important to us if we're talking about Paul writing to the city of Ephesus, where their whole sense of faith and religion had this deep, centuries-old aspect of control and competitiveness for what it meant to be a person of faith. So Paul really wanted to make sure that that control and competitiveness was reframed with their understanding of love. Agape then is important because God is in control of the love. Agape love is actually not something that you or I own or have. It's something that we participate in that spills out of the person of God. And we participate in this together with each other and others that we meet. And God is the source the entire time. And to truly participate in this love then and know that we cannot control it or own it means that we must constantly be learning and growing and experimenting and having give and take together. With God in control and the source, we learn those values of God's love and we do our best to live up to them. And that's distinct from those other types of love that I was just talking about. There are some loves that are about personal control, like philautia, self-love, or eros, or especially mania, holding it within yourself. Or there's those loves that are about a smaller set of people that you kind of negotiate it between for them. That's like philia or ludus. Or there's even those types of love that it's not really about the control of any of one person or another, but there's these external values that are going to impose themselves on that love, and that could end up serving one set of people over another. So in storge, the family or belonging love, there's that sense of, well, you have a duty to whatever this group is, and whoever is in control of the group will tell you what that love is supposed to look like. Same with pragma, for people's interests, if that's what's driving the love, then whoever wants their interest to win out will say, well, this is what it looks like to love me. Or this is the group that has to come out on top as part of doing this love. And agape is completely different than that. Because the love is completely in control of God. So how do we, knowing that this is so important to our faith, to the life of the Christian community, from the writings of Paul, from other writings where this word is so lifted up, how do we operate in the fullness of those characteristics? Not that we'll try to possess it, that we try to participate in it. First, we have to remember that the love is God's. That means it's empowering, but it also means that we can't be the ones that pull all the levers on. We see this in our passage today because in verse 3:14, Paul says that God is the Father from whom every family finds their name. So God is over all of it. God is in control of that love. Also, Paul doesn't ask us to have the love or own the love. Paul says that we should be rooted in God's love, that it's the love of Christ. And so that sense, again, that we are accountable to following God in that love more than we try to take it on ourselves. And we see this, too, in our story with Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael and Isaac. Abraham was trying, and Sarah, too, to control whose family is this, whose legacy, where is this going to go? Ultimately, the family was God. All of it came from the promise that God gave to Abram as he first went out from his father's household. But it was so hard not to have that sense of, like, it's mine. It's my family. I want it to go a certain way. It has to go with this line or that line. But God had room for both of the lines that Abraham did. Even though God gave the promise through Sarah to Isaac, and Abraham's relationship with Hagar represented Abraham trying to take control, God was willing to show love for that as well, even though God didn't tell Abraham to do that. We also need to remember how participating in God's love involves key specific characteristics that we should hold ourselves to most of all. We see this in chapter 4, verses 2 and 3 in Paul's letter. Humility, gentleness, patience, vulnerability, bearing with each other, perseverance, understanding. And that's so different than what we can often have as our values in our relationships, where we can have a little bit of pride creep in. We can have an urgency to get our way. We can have defensiveness, or we can even have sometimes assuming the worst in people who have different values or different experiences than us. And we think that the love means making sure that we let them know all the things that we want differently from them. Again, in the story of Abraham, we have this example of how those types of love have tension with each other. We have Abraham and Sarah, and maybe even Ishmael, when the verses mention that he was mocking Isaac as Isaac was getting older and began weaning. That they all had that sense of control, wanting things their way, of having love being shown that they would be the favorite. And then when those values came out, the love ultimately actually was cut off and couldn't grow and couldn't be moving forward for everyone's benefit. But when people had their moments of vulnerability, when people came to the end of themselves, didn't think that they could have the control to get what they wanted, so all that was left was relying on God and God's values and what God would do for people, with Hagar in the desert in particular. Then suddenly the love pours out. The love creates new opportunity, new life, new possibility that wouldn't have been there before. And lastly, we need to remember that because love is God's, agape love is God's, it actually is more inclusive, not less. It may seem strange and contradictory when we see in verses 4 through 6 in chapter 4 of the letter to Ephesians that there's so much language of one, right? One Father, one love, one faith, one hope, one baptism, one. That seems like, oh, it's like you're trying to focus on one particular thing. But actually that means that there's not competing powers or choosing and excluding, that God can hold everything together. There's also that language we must remember of how wide and long and high and deep is the love of God. How God is able to do immeasurably more than we can imagine. That God is Father of all, over all, through all, in all. More and more inclusive, more and more sense of God says, I've got all of this. And I give each and every one grace. And at the end, in verse 8, where it talks about God giving gifts, Paul uses that to show we're all different types of people. But God gives us each our own types of gifts and we'll make it all work together. Kind of like the body metaphor that we've heard about in Corinthians. Another analogy that came to me this week for thinking about how do we get this idea of, like, focus on one thing actually creates more inclusivity, more possibility, more people being able to be a part of what's happening, that maximizes love rather than shrinks it down. And yet also still has that sense of there are certain boundaries, there are certain standards, there are certain values that we hold ourselves to. It's not just about letting everything go however it happens to go. We don't know how to have that sense of boundary and justice and the way things should be. The metaphor that came to me was sports. I don't know how much that's really important to all of you. I'm sure to a decent number of people there's at least some element of that. But think about how in sports the whole team is supposed to put its focus on one ball, but to have a shared goal. And in pretty much all sports, the rules and that focus on the ball together as a team allows different types of people with different body types, with different skill sets, all to come together and cooperate and work to that one ultimate goal together. And yet at the same time, the purpose of the game, the boundaries of the field, the rules give a framework for what it looks like for that team to expect their cooperation and their partnership and their relationships together to be appropriate or not in that love and cooperation that they have. Right? In football, we've got big, giant linemen blocking for quick little running backs or a tall quarterback to throw a pass. You've got running plays. You've got passing plays. You can go short. You can go long. All these different types of people all trying to do one thing together. Same thing in basketball, from short people to tall people. You can do slam dunks, you can do three-pointers. All this stuff enables this whole range of things to happen. Same thing is true in baseball, especially on defense. Even in hockey, volleyball, the list goes on and on and on and on. And that's why in those sports, that sense of the cooperation between all the different roles and all the different types, you get some of those things that aren't just about like, well, did that help us win or lose? Did that help us have a good play or a bad play? We get the sense of like value infringement if certain things aren't done the right way. So like, if you're into sports and you hear that somebody is a ball hog, you know that like that's not just like ineffective. That's like a violation. Like you can't just keep the ball from everyone else. Like you're supposed to pass the ball. It feels like you're doing something really, really wrong. Or on the other hand, if someone is really sloppy with the ball, they do a lot of turnovers. Doesn't just feel like, well, that's going to make us lose, but, you know, whatever, it's fine. It feels like a moral violation if you are too sloppy or too controlling. And many of you know that soccer is my main sport. And I was thinking about this, and the experiences that I'm having right now, I'm coaching Cohen, 6, 7 years old. I'm coaching his soccer team on Sunday afternoon. We have a week off this week, so I've been doing it for about a month and a half so far. And then also this is the culmination of the season in Europe, so like the best championship games are happening for soccer in Europe. But this is the beginning of the season for the crew. So I went to some games the other day too. And if any of you have ever seen little kid soccer, you know that it's very, very different from real soccer, right? There's plenty of focus on the one ball. But what that means is you've got like a little cluster of kids like all running after the ball in a club together, bumping into each other and jostling and everything. And then occasionally you'll get that one kid who's really, really good and normally really fast too. And so if the ball pops out, they'll be like, I got it. And they're going to go on a beeline to the goal and they're not going to look at anything else. Like blinders on, there's nobody else to see, nobody else to pass to, just let me get it in the goal. Which sometimes, you know, means that's a good play. Sometimes means they like crash into somebody because they have their blinders on so much they don't see people even. So that's like where soccer starts. But then I go and I watch the crew game yesterday, or yesterday was the European Championship, so really the best players in the world going against each other. And you see then when everyone has space, where the ball moves around and there's lots of passing, where you almost have to have the sixth sense of knowing what your teammates are going to do. And so you can see people moving to certain places on the field 2 or 3 steps ahead of when the ball is actually going to get to them because they've planned all this out as a team and they know it so well. It's almost as if there's an invisible force holding them together, making things work like we would expect love to be in all of our relationships. And so we can take that same metaphor to our other relationships or the way that agape love reaches its full meaning, and we say, yeah, we have our focus on the one thing, God's foundation of love, but we don't want the little clusters where we're all expecting everyone to be exactly the same way and no one can be different, no one can be spaced out, no one can have their own identity or skill set. But we also don't want to be where we think we're so great and we have to focus on the one ball and we're the best people at love, and so we're going to do it. We're not going to pass to anyone else or include people that should be included. No matter who we are, what circumstances that we find ourselves, what stage of life, what sense of calling that we might have in ministry, no matter what we think our projects, our tasks, our roles are going to be, we all can find ourselves rooted in God's love, just like Paul asks. This is for all of us, no matter what, in any interaction we have. We want to continue to grow in our participation in God's agape love. We want to grow in our understanding of what it means and what its true nature is. And we should find hope in the promise that God says we experience salvation life for ourselves the most when we root ourselves in that agape love. And then we're called to share that with other people in all of our different relationships, both between ourselves at church and then in how we interact with folks in the community. So how are we able to do this? First of all, we can ask God as much as God can to help us with our humility, our vulnerability, our patience, and our trust. Those values that Paul lifted up so much in verses 2 and 3. We know that this will mean we'll have to let go of some pride. We'll have to let go of having things turn out all the time exactly the way that we like best, or wanting people to be exactly like us. But God will give that to us as a gift. I know that sometimes when we think about humility and vulnerability, it feels like a guilt trip. We must be doing something wrong. I have to, do this deep introspection and say all the things that are bad about myself, but it's more about opening ourselves up to a fuller, broader experience of the possibility of God's love. We don't have it be guilty. We can have it be opening things up to us. As part of that, though, we do also want to take a posture of learning, because we know that holding people accountable is often a part of our relationships and what we think of as our expression of love, but that's where things can get the most dicey. So we have to start by looking for our own accountability before God, too, before we project accountability on other people. And then we make sure that the values that drive us, what we hold ourselves and others accountable to together in partnership, really are, again, not about what we like best or what we think is the most important, but that we are rooted in God. That we don't own it. We don't own agape. We don't own the values. They're God's. We root ourselves in them, and we go together from that. The values that come up again and again in the Bible about how we're accountable to each other are, one, that we can't be prideful about ourselves and our own desires and ignore God so that we get what we prefer. Sports metaphor for this is be coachable. Let God help you grow. Don't say that I already know everything and everything's all set. There may be some things that we think are fine, but that God will show us this has a negative impact. Just be open to checking ourselves with that. Let God show us. Yeah, I'll open myself up a little bit about it. Secondly, in the Bible we see over and over again that we cannot deny the value of others by expecting them to be exactly like us. That's something that God always holds us accountable to. Don't make other people have to be exactly like you. See that especially in Paul's letters about circumcision, about the food laws and saying that people can eat different ways, and that can also fit in the Christian community. And in sports, this is about saying we don't want all point guards, we don't want all centers, we don't want all quarterbacks, we don't want all wide receivers, we need everybody. And we've got to make sure that there's room for all of them. And lastly, the value that's consistently lifted up in the Bible that we hold ourselves accountable to is that we don't seek our own benefit at the expense of others. And that's why justice is so important to Jesus and in the prophets. That's why Paul instructs people to maybe even do things a little bit differently when you're with other people that have a different value system than you, like around the food laws. If you want to eat a certain way at home, great. If you're coming together and something that you're going to do is going to make somebody feel really uncomfortable and bad about themselves, then just open it up a little bit. This is like stat stuffers in sports, right? We hate to see the person who's like, well, my team's losing, but I'm going to make sure I get like 50 points today. They're missing the point. Gotta have a different value system. We want God to help us connect with those that we can show more love to, more inclusiveness to. We want God to show us who are we leaving out because we're expecting that everyone else cluster around the ball with us and be exactly like us. And then also we want God to show us, who are we intentionally or unintentionally neglecting or mistreating because we've been unable to recognize them being part of God's family. So we haven't been passing them the ball. We just wanted to go up the lane on our own without getting them involved in the game with us. Let's do our best to believe in a love that is more than just what's sweet and mushy and simple. It doesn't have much meaning. Let's try not to be in control of what love is, but instead we can be humble. We can seek to always keep learning, participate in God's, again, how high, how wide, how deep, how long, how immeasurable, how beyond our imagination. It's an amazing thing to be a part of. I wouldn't want to miss out on that if I could possibly help it. That love is what's offered to us that is so powerful in transformation for our own lives, for our own relationships, and we know that will have so much impact for everyone around us if we open ourselves up to that exact type of love. Maybe even there's things that we don't, but it's because it's what's beyond our imagination and would be so amazing to be a part of. I invite us to explore that together in this season, in this summer. Show love to each other. We're excited to be back together. Check in with each other. Find out what it is that's going on in people's lives. Find out the things that they're trying to continue to explore and expand what love can be in their other relationships, because we know that there are lots of things that are tricky in the world and in our lives right now too. And if we sort that out together, let's see what God could bring out in our lives and in the people that are not always in this building but become part of our church because of the way that our love becomes more inclusive.